welcome to the new world. Episode 5, Fall from Grace. Last time, I discussed Columbus's second and third voyages, and the issues Columbus and his brothers faced while governing the island colony of Hispaniola. I also talked about how Fernando and Isabel had revoked Columbus's monopoly over the West Indies, and how the entire area, barring Hispaniola, was open to settlement and conquest. Before I get back to the man whose story I hope to finish today, let me instead talk about this sudden wave of other explorers who quickly took advantage of this new situation. Most of them are unimportant to our story. The Spanish men who left were told to A. respect the Treaty of Tordesillas, and B. stay away from Columbus's island to prevent any altercations. Many of these voyages were led by veterans of Columbus's previous voyages, and recruited by men for various Spanish ports, eager for adventure. One such voyage contained a Florentine man, who had been living in Seville by the name of Amerigo Vespucci, who is certainly a very big name in this story. They set out to find pearls like Columbus had on his third voyage, but went even further west to the modern border between Colombia and Venezuela. They also explored Guyana, Curaçao, and Aruba. On their return home, Vespucci wrote to Lorenzo de Medici in Florence, stating that this may have been part of an entirely new landmass, not just Asia like Columbus kept insisting. In time, he will be contracted by the Portuguese crown to do some more exploring of this continent, and by 1507, a book called The Introduction to Cosmography will be published, including a world map with a landmass to the west named America, in Vespucci's honor. The mapmakers had gotten their hands on an account of his travels that credited the discovery of this new continent to him, so they went along with it. By the mid-1500s, this name had stuck, and that's how we have North and South America. I know it's rather anticlimactic, but sometimes that's just the way nomenclature turns out. The other voyage I wanted to mention actually wasn't a Spanish one, but a Portuguese. In 1500, Pedro Alvarez Cabral left the Cape Verde Islands with 13 ships headed for India, following up on Vasco da Gama's successful trip to that place only 2 years earlier. However, rather than closely following the coast of Africa, he made a wide arc to the southwest, a little too wide, actually. On April 22nd, they found themselves at a big landmass that just so happened to fall east of the Tordesillas line. Probably thinking to himself, well, hey, that's convenient. Cabral claimed the land for Portugal, and stayed for 10 days before continuing his initial voyage. That's how Brazil was discovered. There were by now, of course, a great many more voyages to the New World, both undocumented and documented, from ships big and small, and from many captains of many national origins. Everyone wanted in on this mysterious place to the west. I said I'd get to John Cabot soon, but that's going to have to wait for another episode because I have a lot to talk about. Anyway, let's get back to our friend Columbus and his quote-unquote friend, Francisco de Bobadilla. The Spanish court had gotten word of the whole situation with Roldan and his rebellion last time, and they decided to send Bobadilla, an accomplished public servant and military leader, to go assess the situation on the island and deliver justice to anyone responsible. However, public opinion about Columbus had really changed by now. It had been so long since he'd set out with the promise of bringing back gold in loads, but he really hadn't delivered. Was it really because he was incompetent? Or were he and Bartolomeo doing what Roldan had accused them of, and selling the gold off to the Republic of Genoa for personal profit? After all, he was sending only slaves back, who the crown didn't even want, because they had told him to Christianize these natives, not put them in chains. Isabel and Fernando were getting really tired of this guy, so before Bobadilla left, they amended his orders. They named him the new governor of Hispaniola and put him in charge of cleaning up Columbus's mess. Columbus himself didn't get word of this exactly. He did get a letter straight from the monarchy telling him that Bobadilla was doing what they wanted, so please follow his instructions. So, in 1500, Bobadilla set off from Seville, landing in Santo Domingo on August 25th. He expected to be met by Columbus himself, but instead found his brother Diego in charge of the city, while Bartolomeo and Cristoforo hunted rebels inland. While Roldan was pacified, living it up in modern Haiti, there were still plenty of people on Hispaniola who weren't happy with the rulership of the brothers. Bobadilla stepped off the boat and walked straight to Diego's house, where he flashed his letter of appointment at Columbus. Diego immediately sent word for his brothers, who came back to Santo Domingo in a huff. Columbus was furious, refusing to believe Bobadilla was actually coming to replace him. Him! He's the damn admiral! He raised so much of a fuss that Bobadilla threw him and his brothers in a cage on the spot. Bobadilla then investigated the many, many complaints of the Hispaniolans, who told him all about their numerous gripes with the man they were now calling Pharaoh Columbus. Bobadilla decided that he'd heard enough and sent the Columbus brothers home to Spain. And then he set to work turning the colony around, which he did. To those Columbus had imprisoned, he released. Those Tainos who had to pay tribute to Santo Domingo were freed. Now, if a Spanish person wanted native help with something, he had to pay them first. Finally, he expanded the gold mines in the center of the island. Immediately, things were beginning to get better for pretty much everyone. When Columbus reached Spain, he found himself not in as deep trouble as things seemed. Fernando and Isabel did want him removed, but not imprisoned, so they let him out of the chains he'd been locked in throughout the voyage. Bobadilla, though he was making some serious success, had gone a little too far. With new troubles flaring up among the by now very oppressed Muslim communities in Granada, the monarchs found themselves beset by troubles. They needed someone capable and trustworthy, so they replaced Bobadilla with Nicolás de Ovando y Cáceres, a knight from the Order of Alcantara, who I won't spend too much time talking about. Just know that he left with a massive number of 2,500 settlers on 27 ships, and an order to please, please, please get to Christianizing those Tainos already. It's a bad look for us to be, you know, so cosmopolitan and tolerant of other religions. One other interesting note was that among the settlers Governor Ovando took with him was a man named Bartolomé de las Casas, who would later become a priest and an extremely outspoken critic against many of the Spanish practices in the New World, particularly their treatment of Native Americans. He also acts as an excellent primary source for what life was like in this time and place. Columbus, now free from bondage, somehow managed to coax the monarchs into giving him one more voyage. I suppose they didn't need too much to worry about. After all, their main issue with him was that he was a bad governor, not a bad sailor. In 1502, he set off with his brothers and 13-year-old illegitimate son Fernando on 4 caravels, still thinking that Asia was right there and that he might find the Straits of Malacca by modern Malaysia. He was instructed to not go into Santo Domingo unless absolutely necessary, but he couldn't resist. He made the excuse that he wanted to exchange one of his slow ships for a faster one, but he might have just wanted to see how his colony was doing without him. Here, he sent a man ashore to tell Ovando of his intentions, and also that a storm was likely headed their way. Ovando, who intended to send a fleet of ships filled with gold back to Spain, one of the first so-called treasure fleets, not only denied Columbus's request, but also ignored the storm warning. However, he failed to realize that Columbus, despite his many personal flaws, actually was a good sailor, and knew a storm was coming when he saw it. Sure enough, a few days later, a massive hurricane hit Hispaniola. The treasure fleet, which had already set sail, was utterly ravaged. 23 of the 24 ships were sunk. Aboard were Bobadilla, Roldan, and 200,000 pesos of gold, with the only ship surviving supposedly containing Columbus's share of the gold, according to Douglas Hunter. The admiral had pulled into a bay on the side of Hispaniola and suffered minimal damage. You'd think this literal disaster would be a bad look for Ovando. However, that guy actually managed to turn things around, for the Spanish at least. He rebuilt Santo Domingo out of stone this time, got the gold mines back up and running again, and pacified any and all rebellious Spaniards and Tainos left on the island. Within a year or so, he was more successful than Columbus or even Bobadilla had ever been. However, he did institute an economic system known as the encomienda system, which had already been in use in Granada. This allowed the Spanish to, quote-unquote, recruit native labor to work in mines or fields, and while they theoretically were paid and, quote-unquote, civilized in return, they were in reality slaves, and treated as such. This system would lead to great misery for the Tainos, and great wealth for the Spanish. In time, it would be extended to all the Spanish possessions in the New World, and it's one of the more horrific examples of treatment of Native Americans in history. Columbus, who was doing much better than Ovando in the short term, set out for the west, to the tip of Cuba, then to the southwest, where he landed on the coast of Honduras, farther west than anyone had ever been. Here, he met some interesting natives who likely belonged to a group of people called the Paya. Hugh Thomas claims that these people practiced slash-and-burn agriculture and lived in villages of up to 500 people. The men dressed in ponchos and the women wore knee-length bark skirts. They were also adept in woodworking and clay pottery, making pots and stools and spoons and all sorts of things. Two interesting encounters between the Spanish and the natives happened here. Firstly, two girls had been left on the beach by themselves. Columbus and his men, perhaps out of some desire to make them modest-looking, captured them, brought them aboard, had them dressed in European style, complete with shoes, and then kicked off the boat back where they found them. The Paya came back for the girls and promptly undressed them again. Secondly, Columbus encountered a massive native trading vessel. He claimed it was a canoe as long as a European galley and 8 feet wide, supposedly carved out of a single tree trunk, complete with a massive palm leaf awning. Aboard were people not native to this region, 25 traders from the civilization of the Mayans far to the north. Let me just quote Thomas directly. They were carrying embroidered shirts of dyed cotton, cotton cloaks, breech clouts, long swords of wood with a groove on each side into which flints had been set, good copper hatchets, what seemed to be hawks, bells of copper, and a certain wine made of maize, like the beer of England. Also aboard were tools made of onyx and cocoa beans, which the Mayans used as a form of currency. This was the first real contact between Spain and the powerful, sophisticated states of Mesoamerica, and the Spanish left mightily impressed. Columbus was tempted to head north to the Yucatan Peninsula where these Mayans came from, and he probably should have. But when they told him of a supposed strait to the south, he just couldn't help himself. The poor guy still refused to believe he was not in Asia and that the Strait of Malacca was just to the south. He went on past Nicaragua to modern Panama, taking time to note the stone structures and large amounts of merchant ships going back and forth along the coast. Columbus's ships were starting to be seriously degraded here by termites and the weather, so he turned back and put in on Jamaica for repairs. However, he was running out of food, and the repairs necessary would take far too long, so he sent two of his men, Mendez and Fieschi, to go to Hispaniola to get help. How did they get there, you might ask? Well, they managed to rope some locals into paddling them there on a single canoe. They ran out of water on the trip, and one of the Tainos died, but they made it. Mendez and Fieschi then split up, with Fieschi going east to Santo Domingo, and Mendez walking to the west, where he met with Governor Ovando. Ovando still despised Columbus, so he flat out refused to help, or at the very least, he delayed Mendez long enough that the guy just gave up, walked 200 miles back to Santo Domingo, and personally bought ships to send to Jamaica. While he was gone, some men led by two guys known as the Porras brothers led a mutiny against Columbus. They wanted to go back to Castile, and now. So they stole the few canoes Columbus had procured, and set off with many other men, and they headed for Hispaniola like Mendez and Fieschi had. However, facing bad winds and big waves, they turned around only about 12 miles from shore. They landed on the east side of the island and shamefully walked back to Columbus's camp, raiding Taino settlements as they went. The Tainos threatened to stop giving the Spanish food, but Columbus somehow pulled a neat trick by predicting a lunar eclipse using his fancy books, and he so impressed them into giving him some more food. Finally, the ship sent by Mendez arrived, and everyone sailed back to Santo Domingo, where Ovando reluctantly let Columbus stay, though he made sure to free the Porras brothers as a nice middle finger. On September 12, 1504, Columbus and his son Fernando went back to Spain. Columbus's fourth and final voyage was over. And spoiler alert, in 2 years, he'll be dead. Things looked little better for the Spanish monarchs as well. By the time Columbus made it home, Queen Isabel was on her deathbed. One of the last acts she did was the order of a construction of a colony in modern-day Colombia, the first Spanish settlement on the mainland. She also made sure to include a provision in her will that the Americas must be Christianized, as that was her chief goal all along. She died on November 26, 1504, and had reigned for 30 very successful years. Her daughter Juana succeeded her as Queen of Castile, alongside her Habsburg husband Philip, but Philip would die a year later, and the despondent Juana was incapable of ruling. King Fernando of Aragon, Isabel's husband, of course, had to reassume the mantle of rulership as the regent of Castile in his daughter's name in 1506. But what of Columbus? Well, he kept pressing for his old title. If not for himself, then for his son. I'd imagine he still dreamed of one day returning to Hispaniola, or traveling at last to China. But this never occurred. He died on May 20th, 1506, likely from complications with his gout, which he was often incapacitated by. He was 54 years old, and despite all his setbacks, he died a very wealthy and accomplished man. What can we make of Christopher Columbus? Well, to start, he isn't the monolithic figure your elementary school education might have made him out to be. No one is. We've seen that he was a good sailor, but a poor governor. He was braggadocious and made promises that he couldn't keep, either because it was impossible or because he was incapable. He struggled to maintain a functioning colony on Hispaniola for years before his successors turned things around incredibly quickly. He refused to believe he was anywhere other than Asia and ignored all evidence to the contrary. He was a deeply religious man who proposed reconquering Jerusalem to the Catholic monarchs on more than one occasion, yet he made no effort to convert the Tainos to Christianity, as if they ever really needed to be. Instead, he killed and enslaved thousands of Tainos, and dreamed of doing so to many thousands more. He was a greedy man. His own greatest achievement, the discovery of America, was the result of an accident. It was a happy coincidence that something was in his way between him and the Far East. Otherwise, he might have starved to death out on the open sea, or turned around long before that in shame. Yet despite all that, he's the man who began an era. There's a huge dividing line in American history. Everything that happened before 1492, and everything that happened after. He's the man who helped create a truly global and interconnected world, where people from everywhere on Earth could engage in commerce and communication. It's such a shame, then, that there had to be so much suffering because of it. While he was the protagonist of our story, I've done my best not to lionize him as much as previous histories have. He was a man who was perfectly capable of inflicting cruelties not only on the indigenous peoples of the Caribbean, but also on his own Spanish settlers. I mean, they called him Pharaoh Columbus for a reason. But as bad as Pharaoh Columbus was, the people of the New World were now set to meet far worse. I've tried to neither lionize nor demonize the man in these episodes as well, because he was just a man. If someone else had sailed to the New World, and there certainly would have been someone else, then we might have had many of the same criticisms with them of all of the horrors to follow. Whatever the case, I would encourage you to make your own judgments on the man, and think about the meaning of things like Columbus Day in our society. One thing I think we can all agree, though, is that Leif Erikson was just cooler anyway. I mean, that guy was a Viking, and he was a Christian.